My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Pacific Group. My sobriety date is October 31st, 1958. Let's open this meeting with a serenity prayer. Read that just a little too far, didn't I? I was listening to you talk tonight, and I want to correct my statement, my answer to you. Now that I've been with you this weekend, the answer is one too many. And I want to congratulate the young man who got a book tonight. I gave him a book, and I wasn't sure if he was an alcoholic, but when we talked at the podium, I became convinced. But there's something, it irritates me to say, to see drinking newcomers looking healthier than I do. There's something wrong with this program. Let me just... This really has been a sensational weekend. I really enjoyed the meetings, and I'm sure you have too. We heard, I missed Friday because I was on an airplane, so I missed Franny. Which one? I don't know who Franny is. Who's Franny? Francine, is she here?
Franny's in the back, probably.
Francine, are you in the back? I guess she heard what she came to hear. And Scott and his charming wife, I missed that because I had to on an airplane. But I heard them today, and they were good, fine. Enjoyed Scott this morning. And Polly, my old friend Polly, and this afternoon we heard the wizard from Tampa, as we know him. And Michael. And it's really, some of the talks got a little metaphysical for a Norwegian. That's not the fault of the talk, that's the fault of the receiving machine. I have a tendency to sometimes do things wrong. I was thinking tonight, when he's saying, you people in the back, sit down, sit down. I believe in that. That was, a few years ago, I got a call from Dr. Persh, who was a very famous alcoholic treatment doctor in the Naval Hospital in Long Beach, and all the celebrities were sent to him for... he called me one day and says, I have Mrs. Ford, Betty Ford, here to be sobered up, and she's going to go to her first outside meeting at this meeting down in someplace south of Long Beach, and the president, ex-president Ford, is going to be with her. And I know you're going to speak there, but when you talk, please try to describe alcoholism so the president can understand it. Right. Now, don't laugh. A lot of people came up after last night and said, I now understand alcoholism. Because that's why I described it, from the inside up. So I went down there, and there's a big crowd. But the room wasn't this big, there's a big crowd. But there sat President and Mrs. Ford. He was no longer president, of course. But there, president, people were just... And I got up, and there were some empty seats in the front. Oh, God, look what you did to my water. You learn to react like that instantly when you're old timer. Fill it up, Bill. You're on probation. But people are, and I got up, there were some two or three seats in the front row, as usual, not meeting, and some goof standing around the door. And I said, why don't you guys in the front and the back sit down here? We don't want to. I said, come on, sit down. It won't hurt you. You won't catch anything. We don't want to. I said, how the hell with you? Stay there then. So I gave a good talk. And after the meeting, the secretary came up and said, those were the president's secret servicemen. They're not allowed to sit down. Oh, shit. I gave them a false name and drove away. But I'm here, now we've heard some great talks on the steps. We will again tomorrow from Dick and the Wizard of Tampa again. I don't really think of him that way, but it makes him feel good. I'm going to talk about something else tonight. Since I've got a little more sobriety than anybody else, and I've probably been around a little bit more than most of you, as I mentioned last night, a lot of countries around the world and so on. And from time to time in AA, there are new suggestions on how AA can be approved. And in fact, there's been a number of them starting in 1970 after the International Convention that you hear about here and there. And they all sound pretty good. And there's a movement afoot to change our entrance requirements. Why should we? Because there's so many young people on drugs these days. Everybody's on drugs, it seems like. Aren't we doing them and ourselves a disservice by insisting they be alcoholics to be members of Alcoholics Anonymous? Because after all, it is one big disease, and we're being very iconoclastic by not allowing them in. Another movement that peaked about 3 years ago was maybe it's time to change the book, to update it. It's written in a kind of an archaic 1930s style. It's a nice book, but it doesn't capture young people's mind. There isn't enough movement in it to act. It should be a little more dynamic. Another movement is that perhaps we should contemplate the changing of this an anonymity. Because once upon a time in 1935, anonymity obviously was necessary but to protect people, but not anymore. God, it's almost a mark of distinction to be an AA, sober member of AA. People put on their resume now, I'm a sober member of AA. Yeah. And we say you it's ridiculous. A lot of people still outside of us don't come here because they think of AA's group of old people in black overcoats sitting around talking about drinking wine or something, so they don't even want to come because it's a fact of life. And I didn't mention this last night, but I mentioned this to two types of alcoholics and one type, the kind that have to drink again, and there's now 2.5 million of these alcoholics sober. But even so, in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, and in, you know, there's areas of great enthusiasm. Southern California is one. There's more sober alcoholics south of Santa Barbara than there are in New York and Illinois combined. It's just a hotbed. And there's a hotbed here in Florida. A lot of people still think that Akron is the heartbeat of AA. Akron has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. But even in America, where all the sobriety has been estimated by people who have some insight, or the National Institute of Health, I guess, that probably something over 90% of alcoholics of our type in America still die drunk, or it's a direct result of drinking. Many of them never get to AA. Many of them go to AA, don't stay long enough to have anything happen. They go away and say, I've tried AA. And it's just it's a terrible thing. A lot of slippers, a lot of people. And it's just a remarkable thing. And so I'm going to talk about these things just for a little bit. Now, why do we insist you be an alcoholic to be an AA? That seems so confining. There's so many people that need us. And it really, when you think about it, it goes back to this. It goes back to the nature of the disease. Now, there's one emotion every alcoholic in this room has had, as with every alcoholic outside of this room has had. Somewhere along the line, and maybe even tonight, deep in your heart, you know that your case is different. They don't understand it, but it's different. And that has always been the defense against help for alcoholics of our type. I know you mean well, doctor, but you don't understand. I know you mean well, Reverend, but you don't understand. I know you mean well, Padre, but you don't understand. I don't know how to explain it to you, but my problem is not really drinking. It looks like it's drinking, but it isn't. It's something, I'm too sensitive. I have no coding for my emotions, it seems like. You know, it's like you're born without the coding that's supposed to go over it to protect you against excessive feelings. Thousands of years, people have tried to help these alcoholics, and there's never been any answer to it. Because people, yes, I'll get sober for you, sir, or dear, or doctor. But pretty soon, when the emotions start coming, and the world gets gray, and you feel the desperation starting to choke you, and you can try all the therapies you want, but you know the answer is just right here. They say, how could you do that? And as I said last night, there's an answer. If your wife or husband or someone who loves you, your child, says to you, how could you do that? You promised you're doing better. And the only answer to that is leave me alone, because I don't know how to explain it. Now, what would happen? Why is it working? Why is sobriety available now? Because two guys got together. Well, we all know what happened. Roland, this rich boy, rich man, 35 years old or so in New York, was very, very nervous. He'd get nervous spells, and that would make him drink a lot, and his parents were very concerned about it. So they sent him for treatment for his nervousness. They found the best psychiatrist in the world and wrote to him and asked him to take the case. A lot of people don't know this. They wrote to Dr. Freud, and Dr. Freud refused to take the case, which is the first break we ever got. We'd all be sitting here tonight drunk and saying, but I dreamt I was sober. And so they went to his colleague, Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung said, bring him to my hospital in Switzerland. And two guys took him to Switzerland and put him in the hospital. And apparently he worked with them for a year to break through the psyche and the ego problems and so on. At the end of a year, he was doing very well. He understood the nature of his problem. He had it under control. They sent him home. On the way home, he stopped in Paris with some friends of his parents. They were so happy. They toasted his new success with a glass of wine. And 3 days later, of course, he's face down, drunk in his own vomit again, and nobody understands why. So they take him back to Dr. Jung and said, we're very sorry, he seemed to have a little relapse. And Dr. Jung refused to take him back. And they said, why? He didn't mean any harm. She said, no, it's not that. He said, I now realize I misdiagnosed his case. I thought he had deep psychological problems, which he did, and I helped him solve them. But his brain problem, he is what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for that condition today in the world at any price. That was 1931, not all that long ago. And Roland, of course, what? He says, what does this mean, doctor? He said, what it means, Roland, is that you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. God, bad news, huh? And Roland says, is there no other alternative? He said, well, in the literature, I've seen some cases of some involuntary psychological reversion they call a spiritual experience, but I've never seen one. He says, I believe that your chances probably are better of being hit by lightning than finding this, because it just strikes at random. And Roland was overcome by this. He went home. He went back and didn't stop in Paris for any celebratory dinners this time, and got in the boat and went home. And on the way home, he apparently did something that he didn't know he was doing, because it happens to all of us who are going to stay here somewhere along the line, at least a preliminary feeling. And that is, you surrender to the fact that you're hopeless. You're helpless. And he came back, and he'd been a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. He wasn't a bad guy. He was a good guy. And he thought, I've done my best for my church, but maybe I should, what can I do? And there was this thing called the Oxford Group going then, which was kind of a, if you want to know, it was like Est, only for spirituality instead of psychological. People, good people got together, wealthy people, and talked about their spiritual growth and how they could help one another and so on. And he had heard about it, and it was in the full cry at that time. It only lasted about 20 years. It just happened to be going full blast when he got here. And so he went to that, and as he wrote later, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could, so when I died drunk, my parents would have a pleasant memory of me. And he went to the Oxford Group and stayed sober and did well and got back in the company, began an executive back in the company again, went to the Oxford Group, tried to help people. And they were very pleased with him. And in a couple of years, his parents said, you're doing so well, Roland. Why don't you go up to our summer home in Vermont and spend a few weeks just for vacation? We've never seen you in better shape. He said, oh, thanks. So arbitrarily, he took a week and went to Vermont. If he'd have gone there a week earlier, we would not be here tonight. If he had gone a week later, we would not be here tonight. Isn't that amazing? Just funny little things. Because when he got there, some friends said, oh, I'm so glad you're here, Roland. One of the guys we used to play with, Ebby, he's in bad shape drinking, and I understand you quit drinking. Would you talk to him? He said, sure, I'll talk to him. He talked to him, and Ebby said, I don't want to hear that religious crap. Leave me alone. And a week later, the guy came back and said, oh, please, you got to help me now, Roland. Ebby crashed his car drunk into a house, and he's violated his probation. I'm going to send him to the penitentiary. And he said, the judge who's going to send him is my father, and he won't listen to me. But he'll listen to you because he knows your father and he knows your story. So he said, okay, Roland. So since I'm here, he went to the judge and said, well, Judge, I know that Ebby's been a heartache to you, but I used to drink too, and I found a way to just stay sober in New York. If you'll release him to me, I'll get him out of Vermont. And the judge says, only because of you and your family, Roland, I know you. Get him out of here, but if he comes back to Vermont, he's going to the penitentiary. So he took him down to New York, put him in a mission on Lower Broadway, got him going to Oxford Group meetings. And Ebby wasn't terribly thrilled about it, but it's better than the alternative. And he started to feel a little better, and stayed sober, and he felt a little better. And after a while, in the Oxford movement, what you had to do was after you found a certain spiritual plateau, you were asked to testify about it to someone else, to tell someone about it, to say what you'd found. Maybe you could help them. And Roland said, Ebby, it's about time for you to testify. And Ebby said, I'm not going to testify. It's embarrassing enough to be here without testifying. He said, you want to go to the penitentiary? I believe I'll testify. But who will I testify to? And he happened to think he had a childhood friend who was even bigger, rummy, ne'er-do-well than he was. And he was somewhere in New York. If I could just find this drunken boob, I could testify to him and he won't even remember it. So we went to work and located this guy, Bill Wilson, in Brooklyn. And went over there and called him and came over to him. Now, in our book, Bill talks about, in his story, Roland, he contacted him, came to the door, looking good, clean cut, fine. He said, how are you doing it, Ebby? He said, I found religion. And that just, Bill drew, oh, Jesus. Come and sit down. And they sat down. And Bill kind of lets it go at that. But I listened to Ebby talk years ago. He gave the only one big talk in his life, that was at the International Convention in 1960. And I was glad to be there because it was just around the corner from where I live. And he talked about how he went in and sat down with Bill, and what really made him angry, he tried to tell him about the spiritual aspects of the Oxford Group, and Bill just said, huh. That's really fascinating, Ebby. So he left into something, a low dudgeon. And what Bill never mentioned in the story is that 3 days later, the Oxford Group sent their closer over. Want to talk to you about your spiritual condition, Mr. Wilson. And Bill reacted like anybody normal would, I suppose. He went on a bigger drunk than one of his life. Screw you and the Oxford Group. And finally he decided to go over and help Ebby one day. So he went over to go to this mission. He got drunk on the way over and got to the mission. Ebby wasn't there, so he gave a short sermon anyway just to help the people. Staggered on down the street. That night he was back in the hospital again. The doctor called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I'm very sorry, but your husband's here again. And I must tell you, he does not have any time left. this may be his last trip in here. He's dying. He's going to die. And she was just flabbergasted. So she called up Ebby and said, Ebby, for old time's sake, would you go down and see Bill? And Bill took a couple, Ebby took a couple guys down. And they said, Bill, you got to find the power greater than yourself. You can't fight it like this. He said, oh, I don't want to hear that religious crap. God, I'm sick enough without hearing that. They went home. And Bill, in the middle of the night, as we know from our book, cried out, woke up and cried out in desperation. Oh, God, if you're there, make yourself known. And he said, almost as though the room seemed to light up. There seemed to be wind blowing. He said, I'm going insane. I'm going insane. My God. And it all went away again. And he told the doctor what had happened. He said, Doctor, am I insane? He said, no. I don't know what you did, but hang on to it. You look different. So he got out of there and he went to the Oxford group with Ebby, stayed sober. Now I think, what's all the stuff about Ebby and Roland and all that stuff? Why would that be necessary? The point is this. If Bill would have, Bill was the most undeserving person to get a spiritual experience you can think of. Now, if you'd have had one, what the very few people that ever had them did, they got active in church work. But he associated somehow with Ebby and trying to stop drinking. So he went to the Oxford group. If Ebby hadn't been the one that got to him, we wouldn't be here, I'll tell you that. And he got very active, and he was helping people. He found drunks on the street, drunks, and take them to the Oxford group meetings. And, these were all very nice people, very wealthy people. These street drunks, sir, I believe you're vomiting on my shoe. But he tried to help him, and he had no place to stay. He'd take him home at night and let him stay on his sofa. And did this month after month, and he stayed sober, just lively. And he got up one morning after about 6 months, and he saw his wife, who once upon a time had been a lovely society lady, now old before her time, putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve so she'd go to work in her job in the cheap department store where she has to take crap all day so Bill could have enough money to try to help these guys in vain. And he had a terrible wave of revulsion. He said, Lois, I'm so sorry. I really thought when that thing happened in the hospital, I had some kind of a calling to help drunks. But I haven't. I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm done doing it. And right there, my friends, your life and mine hung by a thread so thin you can't believe it. He said, I'm no more. He said, I've been trying to help people for 6 months and not one person has stayed sober. And she turned to him and said something in one sentence that changed the course of history and saved our lives. I was having lunch with her in Connecticut at Hartford a few years ago. And I talked to her. I said, how did you ever think that great answer? God, it's just so sorry. She said, I don't know. It didn't seem so wonderful to me. It seemed so obvious. He said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. He said, oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go. And through a series of events, he got the job to go out to Akron, Ohio. And the job blew up, and he stood in the lobby of the Hotel Mayflower. I stood there a few years ago trying to recreate the feeling. I'm kind of a romanticist, I guess. And he had hot May day. He had $10 in his pocket. Either he could pay his hotel bill or take a train back to New York. And he stood there, and over here was a door with a curved little sign that said cocktails over it. It was still there when I was there. Neon sign. And as he said later, I realized that if I just had a drink or two, I could find a way out of this. And he took a couple of steps. Jesus, I just shudder when I think of that, if he had made it. And out of the corner of his eye, saw the wall telephones. And over in small-town hotels, they have a list of all the ministers. And he remembered he'd promised his Oxford group friends he'd call somebody in the Oxford group before he did anything. So he said, okay, I'll go over there. He took the top name and called it. And man, yes? He said, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a drunk from New York and a rum hound, I guess is the phrase he used. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I've got to find someone to talk to in the Oxford group who said, maybe you have a drinking problem. The man said, sir, I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me, this nonsense. And hung up. And the next guy he called wasn't there. And the next guy he called didn't want to talk. And I don't know about you, but in great agony and pain, I did what I said I would do. I'd go. But he called one last one because he's such an odd name, Walter Tunk. He probably won't have to talk to me. He said, Reverend Tunk. My name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I'm trying to find someone. He said, funny, you should call. One of my parishioners was telling me just the other day that her doctor just admitted he was a terrible drunkard. She doesn't know what to do. Stay right there. And so Bill stayed in the phone booth, and the woman called the doctor's house. Thank God they answered, because he wouldn't have stayed there long. And the wife said, well, he can't do it today because the doctor's so drunk. He's laying on the floor here, but we'll get him together tomorrow. So she said, okay. She was the heiress to the U.S. rubber fortune. She had a big home. And so she called back. She got hold of Bill and said, we'll do this. Here's how you take the bus out to, we're going to meet him tomorrow, out to my house. So Bill hung on, and the next morning took the bus out there, and Dr. Bob and his wife and children drove out there. He was so sick, his son had to drive. Some of you know his son. I knew him quite well, young Bob, they called him. He died a couple of years ago. But he always talked about driving out there and his dad just being so sick and said, Ann, damn it, I'll do this for you because it's Mother's Day, and I'm ashamed that I have to be like this, but I'm going to give this guy 10 minutes. I'm so sick of getting the lectures about what I'm drinking. I can't stand it. And they got there. And these two guys met, and they went to a room and came out 4 hours later. And he looked at the doctor and said, Ann, I don't know how to explain this to you. That's the first man I ever talked to who seemed to know how I feel and why I drink. And he said to Bill, could you come and stay with us just a while and talk some more? And Bill thought, let's see, I have no way to get out of town. Yes, I can. So he lived with them, and they talked about the Oxford Group, spiritual advances, the spiritual breakthroughs, the great beautiful things of spirituality. And a couple weeks later, the doctor said, I want you to stay here with my wife because I'm going to the American Medical Association convention along in Atlantic City this year. And I was there last year. They ridiculed me because I was so drunk, and they made fun of me. And I'm going this year. I'm going to be sober, and I'm going to show them what we're doing. And so he went. And Monday morning, 6 o'clock, the phone rang. She said, yes. She said, this is Margaret, the doctor's office nurse. I'm so sorry to tell you this, but they carried the doctor off the train so drunk this morning he couldn't walk. They lay him on the platform. The station agent called me up, and I came down and got him. The cab driver and I hustled him into his office. He's laying on the floor here drunk. I'm so sorry. I know that he was trying, and I don't know what happened. So that was they went down and got him, took this drunken old fool home, and he's, I'm so sorry. I'm as drunk as I always do. You want to sort of crack him. And he put him to bed. And Wednesday morning, his drunk doctor wakes up. Oh, my God, what day is it? He said, Wednesday, Bob. Wednesday. Oh, my God, I've got to do a cancer surgery today. And I've got to do it. I put it off. And I look at my hand, I can't even hold a knife. My God, I'll lose my license. What'll I do? So they got him up and bathed him and got some clothes on him. Bill bought him a couple of drinks to steady his hand. And he went off to the hospital. Supposed to be home about 12:30 or 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock came, no doctor. 2 o'clock, no doctor. 3, 4, 5. They knew where he was, drunk somewhere. 6 o'clock, the car pulled up. He sprung into the house looking like $1 million. He said, oh, boy, what a day I've had. He said, where you been, Bob? He said, I always thought in that Oxford group, they talk about making amends to people. I thought a doctor shouldn't have to make amends. But as I was doing that surgery the day after, of course I should. I'm a human being. And I've been making amends all day today. And it's just, I feel wonderful. And that was June 10th, 1935. That was the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. Although they didn't call it. They didn't know they were doing that. They just thought there were two guys staying sober in the Oxford group. And then they realized that sitting discussing abstract spiritual breakthroughs had not kept anybody sober. What had kept Bill sober was trying to help people. So they found a drunk in the hospital up there. go up and see a guy named Bill D. Jesus, I'm getting tired of that. If you can't handle your drinking, stop. Not my fault. I didn't want to tell you this, but I wasn't nurtured as a child. All right. So they found a drunk in the hospital, and the nun fixed him up, and he didn't want to talk to him. They talked to his wife, says, "We'd like to talk to Bill D., his name was. We'd like to talk to him about his drinking." She went and says, "Bill, there are two men who want to talk to you about their drinking." He said, "I don't want to talk to anybody about drinking. I'm sick of talking to people about drinking." He was a lawyer. I'm so tired of his advice. But she was a strong woman. So pretty soon they went in to see Bill. And Bill later said, I heard him talk. He said, I never heard anybody like that before. They never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and why they felt the way they did. And I said, my God, how do they know about me? And I was so impressed, I stuck with them fellows. I've been with them ever since. And he became number three. And little by little, they got people into their little corner of the Oxford group until the Oxford group finally expelled them. Because the Oxford group said, we're getting together for spiritual matters, and all you people want to talk about is drinking. Most of us don't have a drinking problem. Why don't you go form your own little group somewhere? So they moved to the King School. Which is I was wondering one more little thing. It always amuses me. They finally got a young guy in, about 29. And they didn't know if anybody that young would possibly be an alcoholic, but they put him in anyway. And he got involved with them and doing things, and he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. And she fell in love with him. And they got married. Well, first of all, he had done something, although he didn't do it, that would ring down the halls of shame forever. He brought our group its first relationship. I don't know any word that sends a shudder down a sponsor's spine worse than that word. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. What you need on your desk is a machine that says, uh-huh, uh-huh. And they got married. Now, that sounds romantic. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, married a man that I sponsored. Had been sober 6-7 years. I was not in favor of the marriage. The girls didn't ask me. I'll tell you the absolute clinical version of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything. You're bound by the sanctuary of the confessional, but you can give little clues. You can say, "Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home." Since he was now married to Dr. Bob's daughter, they said, "You're a young guy. You shouldn't be going to all these things we're doing and sitting in the Oxford group and all these things and calling on drunkards. You take care of your wife for a while. You just get to stay in your job and take care of your wife." So they were surprised when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for the next 50 years. But it was just a fact of life. But little by little, AA grew. Now, the point about the whole exhausting story I've just told you is that people begin to stay sober when one person talking to another can use his experience to get through that wall that keeps help out. And from then on, that was always the story of AA. people talking to people to get them to at least open the armor a little bit. What's that? The whole communication of convincing someone that I know how they feel so they will believe what I tell them. That sounds so simple, but it never had been done. And so little by little, they did that. And they began to grow. They got a few people in New York. Most of the people got drunk in those days, you know. Most of the guys who read stories in the first edition drank again. It was not easy staying. There was no, as was said earlier up here, there was no support group at all. But they got to, little by little, they grew. And eventually they wrote this book. And eventually they got some article in the Saturday Post. And that was kind of an interesting thing because they, all of a sudden, all over the country, people heard about something that they might do for their drunken husband, drunken wife, drunken child, that no one had ever been able to help. And here's the people staying sober. And they flooded New York with letters, and the letters came out, and groups started all over the country, all kinds of, everywhere there was a meeting. In Los Angeles, they started one even before that, in 1939, in Miami, and I was like the Miami group. There they found them selling memberships at AA. And the guy said, "We don't mean any harm, it's just down in Florida, if you give them something, they don't think it's worth nothing. If they have to pay for it, they'll believe you. And we send the money to New York," but they discouraged him from doing that. But now all of a sudden there's all kinds of groups all over. A is growing, they've got this book, and they've got the steps, and they're doing great. And by 1942, Bill was starting to get letters. Our group kind of came apart. By 1943, a lot of groups came apart, these new little meetings. By 1944, it came even further apart. And he tried, in a desperation to try to save AA, he started the Grapevine. He thought that'd be some unifying factor in a tabloid size. And it helped a little, not much. In 1945, it seemed like he hardly ever got to work without some bad news from someplace. And a doctor in North Carolina wrote an article for the Grapevine, sent in to Bill, said, "Bill, you ought to read this. I just did some research, and it sounds like us." And the article was about something called the Washingtonians. Six guys in 1840 had gotten together in a bar, and one was just out of jail again. He said to his friends, "I just got out of jail, and that damn chaplain said he knew how I felt. He didn't know how I feel. You guys, the only guys, know how I feel." They said, "That's right. But Jesus, drinking is killing us. Well, maybe we can get together and help each other stay sober." Dumb thing. People laugh. "You drunken boobs. You can't even keep yourself sure you're going to help each other. That's funny." But they stayed sober. And they got somebody heard about it in Philadelphia and came down to Baltimore where they were. And they started a little chapter. They started a little chapter in Washington. And a little chapter in Boston, which really took off. And little by little, at the end of the year, they had several hundred sober people helping each other. And the second year, they got a bunch more people. They got a couple of good speakers, because at that time, entertainment, mass entertainment, there's no movies, no nothing, but there'd be a lecturer. They'd go out and give lectures where people pay money to go hear them talk. They got a couple of these lecturers who had been drinking and got sober and went out and talked up the Oxford group. By 1845, they estimated the membership somewhere around 100,000 sober people in every state. And nothing like it had ever been done before. And in 1845, the leaders of the Oxford group, the Washingtonians, had a thought that seems to be accurate because people in AA have it today, some of our leaders. They thought, "Gosh, if we're able to help drunkards, we should be able to help a lot of people. We should help people whose problem is narcotics, laudanum and opium, not like heroin, cocaine today. We should help people who have got emotional problems. We should go for the stamping out of the sale of alcohol, which would get rid of all the problem. Some of us got involved in getting Texas into the Union. Some of us got involved with the anti-slavery movement." And this whole group just gung-ho, just working out there and help the world. By God! And by 1848, the movement was extinct and most of them died drunk. I'll tell you how extinct they had become. Bill Wilson never heard of them in the 1940s. And he read about that. He went to the library and got some more stuff on it. And he realized, "My God, They got the same problems we had. Because my groups are fighting with each other. For example, Los Angeles would have nothing to do with us boobs in Akron. We'd only write to New York. People in Chicago have nothing to do with New York, write only to Akron. People fighting all over, just terrible, getting drunk. He said, we got to have some kind of unity. And he said, and people think I'm trying to be a dictator. I'm not. It's, how can I explain this to people? And he said, and people are, they're keeping people out. They got rigid requirements in some groups. And they're, and he read the thing. He sat down. And in 1945, in a last gasp effort to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he wrote the 12 traditions based on the Washingtonian and Alcoholics Anonymous experience and introduced them one by one to the membership in the grapevine. And A had a great problem then, and still has, unfortunately. It's comprised of alcoholics. Most people didn't want any damn traditions. We came here to find love, not traditions, goddammit! You know. They explained. They had a terrible time, one by one, in the long form, not the short form we read tonight. If any of you aren't familiar with the long form, in the back of the book, crossing the short form is the long form, which really, that's the way they were written. It fleshes them out considerably. In my home group, we read the long form once a month. But, so Bill, we read about it, got in his motorcycle, put his wife in the sidecar, went around to meetings, tried to talk up the traditions. It got to a point, there's a letter I read in the archives once, said, Bill, we'd like to have you come to talk to our group in Mamaroneck, I guess it was, for our second anniversary. But you got to promise not to talk about the traditions. If you're going to talk about traditions, don't come. I mean, if there's strong emotions. And by 1949, a lot of groups were doing it, a lot of groups weren't. And Bill and Dr. Bob got together and said, if we could just get representatives from all of these damn places and explain it to them, we could maybe they'll understand it. So they got together and they decided to have one big convention. And they had it in Cleveland, July of 1950. And they invited people from all the groups around the country, and they all came, many representatives. And I have the tapes of that convention, very poor quality, but very interesting. Most of the speakers were non-alcoholics because they still were looking for public approval, I guess. The warden of San Quentin and a guy from the health department, very people. But Bill and Dr. Bob each gave a talk. And then they had six young guys, each took two traditions. I don't know who they were, but you could just hear feel their tails wagging. They're just enthusiastic. And they gave me some great talk about the traditions. And at the end of the tradition, they sat down, and Bill was still not sure. It's a hard way to save us, but he did it, he said. Having heard the traditions read, seeing no objections, they're accepted. There was no vote that day, I'll tell you. But they're based on saving AA, and they were quite simple. They addressed the causes that were killing AA. We must have unity, number one. Number two, there's no authority except the group conscience. Number three, the only requirement for members is the desire to stop drinking. Number four, if each group is autonomous. Then the fifth one was the big one. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to alcoholics who still suffer, not people who still suffer, alcoholics. Why is that? Because we are uniquely qualified to help people who are alcoholics, and no one else can, apparently. And so that tradition became very strong. Now, over the years, in Southern California, with its vivacity, in the late 1950s, a guy named Jim Willis, who I knew quite well, and he was a gambler as well as an alcoholic, and he would bring his gambler friends to AA. Yeah. Jesus, Jim, I don't want to hear this guy talk about his getting drunk. I'm not a drinker. To hell with these guys. And so he wanted to help these people. He thought the steps would help him. He wrote to New York and became the first person to get permission to use the 12 steps outside of AA. and he found Gamblers Anonymous, which to this day is still the most successful of all the non-AA groups. And he was very active and got him fun watching him. He'd talk it up and even had me go to a couple of GA meetings. I was kind of new and talk about things I didn't know anything about. Still working, too, here. But in the mid-1960s, he was so active in GA, he didn't get a chance to get to AA much anymore. So everybody was very sad when he got drunk and died. But his picture is still on every wall in GA, because they know he didn't ever gamble again. That's all I care about. And a guy in West, down North Hollywood, they formed over Narcotics Anonymous so that narcotics addicts could go places and identify. Then they formed Cocaine Anonymous out in Marina Del Rey so that cocaine addicts would have a place to go. A woman in downtown near the Wilshire District formed Overeaters Anonymous. And she sold me on why these groups are necessary. And it's just this. When I was about 2 years sober, I still didn't have any front teeth. But I was on fire, boy. And I gave a talk one night at the club on compulsions. And I didn't have any answer for them, but I could explain the compulsions very well. And obsessions, I should say, not compulsions, obsessions. And this rather plump, nice lady came up afterwards and says, I'm a member of AA, but I'm also a compulsive eater, and I've started Overeaters Anonymous. We meet over at Church of Our Savior on Olympic Boulevard. Would you come over on Sunday and talk to our ladies about what you talked about today? I said, sure. I weighed about 125 pounds. I'll give the little broad something to shoot for, baby. So I went over there and talked at this meeting, and I mean, they enjoyed it. And I got done, sat down, said, well, I've helped these ladies. About eight of them around the table. And then they had a little sharing session, and I could not believe what I was hearing. A woman over here said, her son had just had a 10th birthday. He was going to a military school in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to pick him up. She took out the birthday cake, iced it, and took a taste to make sure it was good. Then another taste. Then another taste. By the time they got back, the cake was gone. And she felt just heartsick about it. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I thought to myself, just have a piece of cake, for Christ's sake. What's wrong with you? Woman over here talked about her ice cream obsession. Oh, I love ice cream. My husband's so angry at me sometimes. But I just love, I feel so much better when I eat ice cream. And I eat it, and I just eat it. And I have to sneak out and get it at night and hide it in the house. And I didn't say anything. I'm too nice of me. But I thought, why don't you just, no wonder you're fat, for crying out loud. Anybody would be fat, eat that much ice cream. Woman over here, my favorite, she said, she ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she'd put her finger down her throat and vomit and then eat some more. And I didn't say anything. But I thought to myself, don't bother shaking hands after the meeting. But I thought about that later when I got smarter. What was different? I'm very bright. I understood exactly what they were saying, and I knew exactly what they were doing. But I didn't identify with it, so it was just information. I thought, why would they do something like that? Why would they do something like that? And that is why people like us have a hard time describing alcoholism to our families and loved ones. They want to understand, can't you just have a glass of wine at Christmas? You think, how could you say that? They're trying to be understanding. So you just have to let them observe your changed behavior, and they'll come to like AA, I guess. But that is why it is so essential that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk to alcoholics. Because if I'm not an alcoholic, I'm just giving you information. And you know how to get rid of information. You shine them on. That is why it is imperative that we make sure that our new people become alcoholics. Now, there's one little glitch in the AA today. We have a series of non-alcoholics coming to AA. And they say the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. We got a desire to stop drinking. How do you keep them out? because then you have to go back and read the long form of the tradition from which it was abbreviated, which says, we want to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. When they abbreviated it, they had no idea non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA someday. You can't get alcoholics to come in. Why would non-alcoholics want to come in? But that is why that one thing, certainly, we must keep, I think, because of the treatments for alcoholics of our type in the last 4,000 years, there's only been two with any degree of success, the Washingtonians and Alcoholics Anonymous. And they are the only two that are comprised of drunkard talking to drunkard. All the others are psychiatrists, social workers, well-meaning people, religious appeals, which work for a while, but when the bad times come, you go. So I guess we don't want to change that right now. The second thing, I won't take this long with all the things, but the second thing they want to change is the big book. There's a real movement of that. In fact, that's why we have a book with a blue cover. Hand me that, just a second. Don't come near my water. That's why this book is new. Because there was a great movement in our World Service Office to change the big book. And they compromised finally by keeping 164 pages, changing some of the stories, and changing the cover. But why do people want to change the big book? Why was this movement? Because the big book is written too old-fashioned. It's not, it doesn't grab you, it doesn't make you want to take actions. And, you know, when I first came to AA in 1949 for the first time, a guy in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, had me read the big book. And I was a writer, an incipient writer at that time, and I read the book. And they said some people said it was a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book. It's all right. It's just, its problem is it's terminally dull. Just endlessly dull. Jesus. Some years ago, when I came off Skid Row, my new sponsor had me read the book again. And I read it again, and I realized I was mistaken the first time. It was much duller than I remembered. I mean, I wrote things like, dude, this bias product, damn well, let's go here. Come on, let's go. And he, what are we going to do today? If you are thorough at this stage of your development. I just gave up on the damn book. But I trusted my sponsor. I found out later the things he was telling me was in there, but I didn't know that at the time. But this book is a remarkable thing. It has been mentioned previously this weekend that this book has got a lot of things going for it. In fact, in some places, this book is called a miracle, which doesn't turn me on at all, because if there's a word that's misused in AA a lot, it's miracle. I heard a guy a few years ago, he said, I got up very early this morning, and I saw the sun in the eastern sky, and I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day. And I said, oh, man. Why don't you get up early tomorrow and have another one, you goof? Miracles are supposed to be non-explainable. Why would they call this book a miracle? Well, probably one of the great reasons. There are two reasons. First, this book is the only book I have ever read or known about, and I've read a lot of books, and I still do, that gets smarter every year. It really does. Every August, I read the book at a book study meeting in West L.A., and I read a chapter, and we discuss it, and every year it seemed like I read something. Jesus, that wasn't there last year, was it? You know, because it really is well written when you can't skim. When you got to read it word for word, it really makes sense very good. But it's a smart book. But I'll tell you, why is it a miracle? Because, well, the guy who wrote it did not know enough to write it. It had to be some kind of divine inspiration, a lot of people think. He was 3 years sober. Now, if you're new tonight, young man there, Chris, is that your name? I'll just talk to you now. These others, I don't like their looks. Anyway. Yeah. But if you're new, you think, 3 years sober. Oh, God, you should have known enough to write a book by then. But you will discover when you're 3 years sober, you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that two creams and one sugar or two sugars and one cream? I'll get the goddamn coffee. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Not that they're bad, but let's see how they're going to turn out before we trust them. And this guy, 3 years sober, surrounded mostly by failure, writing it for the worst of motives. He has motives which he could sell 1,000 books and make a lot of money and start an alcoholic hospital. He didn't really care. Wrote this book. No background in psychology or abnormal psychology or medicine or even much sobriety. Wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives of our type in the last 69 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That makes that a miracle. That is a miracle. And people say, well, that's all very nice, but it's still written old-fashioned. And they read it as though it's a novel. And they read it as though, if I really understand this book, I'll be all right. You can memorize this book and stay drunk for the rest of your life if you want to. Because people don't seem to understand that. Knowledge of the big book is not the great answer. This is not really a book. This is a cookbook. And it's full of recipes. Emotional recipes. And you can memorize every one. Just like if you memorized a cookbook. I memorized them all. Why am I starving to death? Yeah. Memorizing them doesn't change nothing. So people sit around sometimes and they read the book and it makes them feel so good they don't change anything they're doing. Oh, I know that now. I guess I can do that again. Yeah. The book is a cookbook. As has been so well described by our speakers and will be again described that way tomorrow. I was very pleased when Sandy gave us an advance of step number 11. That strange thing in there. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. That's about the only thing in AA that I've not violated sometime or another. That and not drinking. But I'm so glad I did, because most of my life when I was a young man, I prayed and prayed to God, and God said no, I guess. And I had a terrible time returning to God. I was sober a little while before I could return to God. But anyway, this book is a remarkable thing. And whatever it does, whatever its writing style, it changes lives. And the recipes they give us are easy to understand and quite clear. And Dr. Bob says, you know, our program should be worked by anybody if he wants to try it. You know, you don't have to be a wizard. You don't have to have great insights. Some people like to have insights. But it's simple and it'll work if you do it. The 12 steps are written for simplicity. And so I'm always afraid when people talk about changing the book. What are you going to change? What are you going to change based on your 28 minutes of sobriety? What are you going to change because it seems that way to you out in Oklahoma where they don't go to meetings anymore? I would like to say maybe they should change the book, but please try it, your new changes in your group for 10 years first and see what happens. Then if it works out, we'll consider it. But I don't want some boob to go, let's change that, let's get rid of this and get rid of that and change him to her. That is one of them. I wish I wouldn't have thought of that. It makes me so goddamn mad. But there are places around the country when they read chapter 5, they say, understand God as you understand God. There's no him, because that hurts the feminist pride. And I want to just go up and say, are you a feminist? Yes, I am. I don't do because I'm too nice a guy, but, you know. But I think it's safe to say we maybe ought to leave the book alone. It's the only thing that's ever worked for people like us, and I'd want to change whatever you want in the story, do whatever you want to do, but those 164 pages are magic. They are God's revealed word as far as I'm concerned. And the last thing I want to talk about just a little bit is about anonymity. Because, you know, anonymity is practically gone anyway. These movie actors come out and say, I'm an AA now! And people break their anonymity. And what's the purpose of it? Maybe once upon a time, you know, they used to, when the AA was first formed, they had the most garish red and yellow cover. Remember, I talked to old-timers who were sober then. They'd have to hide them under the coats when they got on the bus, you know. But and people were afraid to be known as alcoholics. But those days are long gone. And of course, you've got to come to realize the meaning of that anonymity tradition has changed too over the years. It turns out that anonymity is not really to protect us at all. It's to protect me. That must have been the Virgin Mary. Anyway. Except we Lutherans don't recognize her, so it's all right. Yeah. I know when I was brand new, I remember I got a great great investigation of that. The first year I was sober, a woman named Lillian Roth, a famous singer, wrote a book called I'll Cry Tomorrow. And they made a movie out of it with Susan Hayward. And her sponsor said, now remember, don't mention AA in there. She's, oh, I'm going to mention AA prominently. When people know that Lillian Roth is in AA, they will want to come. It isn't a bunch of old guys in black overcoats. It's Lillian Roth, the famous singer. So she did that. And a couple years later, when she was laying face down drunk in her own vomit in Palm Springs, I don't know what people thought about AA. I don't suppose they even thought about it. But the next year, a woman named Diana Barrymore, who was John Barrymore's daughter, wrote a book. And she thanked AA for what they'd done for her. She took it a step further. Because of AA, now she could have wine with dinner. And I, when she died drunk in the Malibu drunk tank, I don't suppose anybody cared. But again and again and again, I've watched that happen. I've never seen anyone profit from breaking their anonymity. And of course you might say, well, I surely don't think God's in heaven saying, okay, you broke your anonymity, I'm going to have to destroy you. That's ridiculous. I believe it's a loving God. I think we bring destruction on ourselves when we do it. And I've often wondered, why would that be? Why would that be? And I guess it's, as I can conceive it, if anonymity is first of all, let me just take one moment to describe what anonymity is. Because of the nature of my work in Los Angeles, because I've been a long-time recovered alcoholic, I get interviewed a lot on television and radio and been articles about me in the paper and in Reader's Digest even. And in each case, I'm identified as a recovered alcoholic or recovering alcoholic. And people say, you broke your anonymity. I said, no, I didn't. Where you break your anonymity, because I am a recovered alcoholic, what can I say? Where you break your anonymity when you say, I'm an AA. When I mention AA, no longer my name, no longer my face, no longer identification. I don't know if any of you remember, in the year 2000, A&E had an hour-long special on AA. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And they had a bunch of speakers, four speakers from around the country. I was the speaker in Los Angeles. Perhaps now you remember me. But anonymity is when I use AA for my purposes. And every time people, remember in 1972, one of the presidential candidates, a sober alcoholic, mentioned he was an AA. He thought it'd give him a great surge in his career. It just dumped him further down. Because nobody really cared one way or another. But the purpose of anonymity seems to me, it's almost like a tent. Over anonymity prevents me, makes me desist from using my AA for my ego, for my own self-aggrandizement, for whatever it might be, for any purpose. I surrender my name and I surrender my ego to the best of my ability under that tent. And if I break through that and say, I'm a member of AA and I'm going to help these people because a guy like me is in AA, that'll draw people. I now put myself above the tent and there's no protection. And now I'm alone up there, and if some things go wrong, I have no place to turn because I've already helped AA. I have to find something else. That's happened to several AA members that I know. That they have to go to a psychiatrist and go to medications and eventually go crazy. We talked about one before the meeting. Someone asked me about him. So anonymity, it's an interesting thing. The last letter Bill Wilson wrote before he died here in Miami, and incidentally, those plants that are, they were brought here by a sincere AA member named Fast Eddie. I just threw that in for the hell of it. But anyway, the last letter Bill Wilson ever wrote before he died was explaining anonymity. You've got to remain anonymous, not because you protect yourself. It's such a spiritual protection. It's a spiritual protection. And so that's why we maintain our anonymity. And I hope we always do. As I say, I've never seen anyone break their anonymity and profit from it, because it seems to change your relationship to everything. And so really, the three big movements we talked about, why do you have to be an alcoholic? Can't we just let anybody in? Not really, if we want them to stay sober. And maybe we should change the book? Maybe, but you show me what you want to change and practice it for 10 years and let me know. And anonymity, I may want to use it for my own purposes. No, I'm not. Not if I want to stay sober, have some degree of sanity left. And so we are really pretty good. I was going to talk about, where do we go from here? We don't go anywhere. We listen to these people talk about the steps. We read the traditions in our group and understand what they say. And perhaps individually read the long form from time to time, because they are so explainable. To realize that we are blessed. You know, we are all blessed in a way that nobody ever thinks about. It's so simple. Through no merit of our own, we have been born into the only window where there's treatment for people like us in the history of mankind. And we think we're doing AA a favor by going to it. Isn't that something? Now I was thinking the last thing, you know, the long form of the traditions, which are quite impressive. You know, let me say one more. I'll get this quickly. But in that convention in Cleveland, went so well, they decided to have another one in St. Louis, 5 years from then. That went so well, they decided to have another one in Long Beach. And that's where our 5-year conventions come from, because they wanted people to understand about the traditions. And the one in Cleveland, Dr. Bob was dying of cancer at the convention. And they said, well, you probably won't want to talk, Bob. He said, oh, I've got to talk. He said, I'm 15 years sober. That's the second longest sobriety in the world. And I've got to talk. So his son on one side, and his guy on the other side, took this tall, gaunt, dying man to the podium. And he gave a little talk which many people conceive to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have it on the wall at the World Service Office. You come off the elevator, that talk. It's just remarkable. A lot of people never heard of it. At first he got up, he just gave the usual thing that people talk about. He says, well, he said, I'm so happy to be here, and I look over this vast crowd, and I'm glad that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He says, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months. My health hasn't recovered the way it thought it would be. Hope it will soon. He said, and he said a couple other little cornball things, but then he said, I would like to call your attention to one or two things that may be of interest. Because he was a great communicator of AA. He was a better 12-stepper than Bill Wilson was by far. He was a goer boy in his day. And he was trying, it was almost like a deathbed testament. He was trying to say, trying to convey. He knew he only had a couple of minutes, so he had to sit down. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. There isn't a person in this world who doesn't understand exactly what he's talking about. We're all wonderful people and full of love when things are going our way. Program's wonderful. I love everybody. Don't resent anybody. But let somebody hurt my feelings or say something bad about me or threaten me. You may even give them the ultimate insult. I don't even think that son of a bitch is alcoholic. Isn't that funny? We fight our whole lives against that, and then the worst thing could be called, I'm not, yes I am, I am, I am, I am. I am. And finally he said, let us never become too busy so we are unable to help our fellow man, to perhaps explain things to him, to take him to a few meetings, to pat him on the back. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we are too busy to help our fellow man who still struggles in the throes of his illness. He said thank you and sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But that is really such a touching thing. It's as appropriate tonight here as it is was there and all over the world. And the last phrase of the 12 traditions long form, I just love this, because it really tells us why we do all these things. It was addressed for anonymity, but it's for everything else we do here. Love and service to everything. This to the end, that our great blessings will never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all.